This is episode 140 of the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. When is a nursing home allowed to discharge a resident? The Nursing Home Abuse Podcast is dedicated to providing news and information for families whose loved ones have been injured in a nursing home. Here are your hosts, Georgia attorneys Rob Schenck and Will Smith. Hey out there, welcome back. My name is Rob Schenck and I am the host. I am your host. Hostess with the mostest for this particular episode of the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. I thank you for joining us. We're going to have a great episode today. We're going to be talking about a growing problem in nursing homes today, and that's the problem of wrongful eviction. And at the top of the show, I said discharge, as in discharging a resident from the nursing home, and that's, I feel like that's the term of art that is often used. But as I'll get into the discussion with our guest, I think eviction is a better use of the term because these are residents. This is a home. And when you're kicked out of your home, that's usually called an eviction. But it's a growing problem for the reasons that we're going to discuss. Most of them have to do with money. But I am bringing on a really great trial lawyer on this program. He is with the AARP. He's a fantastic guy. Glad to have him on the show. His name is Bill Rivera. Bill is the Senior Vice President for Litigation at the AARP Foundation, where he leads and provides strategic direction for AARP Foundation litigation, AFL. As the head of AFL, Bill manages a team of about a dozen litigators who advocate nationwide for the rights of people age 50 and older, addressing diverse legal issues that affect their daily lives and ensuring that they have a voice in the judicial system. The team litigates and files amicus briefs in cases involving, among other things, employment discrimination, employee benefits, housing, consumer protection, and elder justice. Immediately prior to joining the AARP Foundation, Bill served as Deputy Associate General Counsel and Chief of Litigation in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of the General Counsel. Bill is a graduate of Brown University and Stanford Law School. He spent a year as a Fulbright Scholar at the University of Stockholm in Sweden and has served on a number of nonprofit boards, including as president of the Hispanic Bar Association of District of Columbia. So he is extremely qualified, and I would say he's in the trenches. He's fighting the good fight in courts to bring justice for nursing home residents who have been wrongfully evicted, and I'm glad that we get to pick his brain on that in this episode. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Great. So, Bill, one of the main reasons why I wanted to have you on the show today was to talk about this issue with what I call evictions. And some people say discharge or whatever, but it's basically evictions. But when a resident is wrongfully evicted from a nursing home. And I wanted to get your perspective on that because you're an authority on this. So I guess for our listeners out there who are mostly just family members, they're not attorneys. They don't have an understanding of, you know, the law, let alone landlord-tenant law or nursing home regulations. But just from a layman's standpoint, when is it okay for a nursing home to discharge or evict a resident?
Well, again, thanks so much for having me on. I think this is really a very topical question. It really is one of the, if not the leading complaints about nursing facilities in the country. And it is such a frightening and traumatic experience for residents and their families, as you know. At minimum, it's stressful and disruptive to worry about. I think eviction is the right term. You're being thrown out of your home. And, you know, that kind of trauma leaves people frightened and disoriented, isolate them from their loved ones. If they can't get back to where they're supposed to be, they can really deteriorate physically and mentally. So, you know, it's a huge problem. It is okay for nursing homes to discharge residents under very specific circumstances. And Congress was very aware of the circumstances and the challenges that a wrongful eviction can present. So they really limited the circumstances under which a facility can discharge someone. So if you're a federally certified nursing facility, and most of them are, that means they accept Medicare and Medicaid patients. And even if you are not a Medicare or Medicaid patient, this is true. You can only be discharged for six specific reasons. And it's helpful, I think, for families to understand that the resident has a right to remain in the facility, and they cannot be discharged unless one of those six reasons is provided and documented and done properly. So those six are: one, the transfer or the discharge is necessary for the resident's particular welfare, and the resident's needs cannot be met in the facility. Two, the discharge is appropriate because the resident's health has improved sufficiently, so the resident no longer needs the services provided by the facility. So if you don't need the services, that may be a reason to say, okay, it's time for you to leave. Three, the safety of the individuals in the facility is endangered due to the clinical or behavioral status of the resident. Obviously, a facility has a legitimate interest in the safety of the people who work and live in its facility, and if you are actually threatening the safety of other people due to your behavioral or clinical status, that may be a reason for a discharge. Fourth, the health of individuals in the facility would otherwise be endangered. Again, thinking about the other people in the facility that the facility is responsible for. Five, the resident has failed after a reasonable and appropriate notice to pay for a stay at the facility. Facilities are running businesses. They are entitled to be compensated for the services that they provide. But as we can talk about as well today, the change from Medicare to Medicaid, for example, is not a basis for evicting someone. So long as you have, for example, applied to get Medicaid, if your Medicare coverage for the stay has run out, you still have a right to remain in that facility. And finally, six is if the facility ceases to operate, and that one is not that common, but still does come up. But obviously, if a facility is no longer going to be in the business of providing those services, then it can discharge the individuals who are in the facility. And even when they have those, even if they can find one of those six reasons, there are still a number of procedural rights that individuals have to make sure that the basis is correct and that the facility is actually behaving according to the regulations.
And Bill, so just so that the listener knows that you're not pulling this out of thin air, these are coming directly from the federal regulations that govern nursing homes. As you said, almost all nursing homes, and it's because they accept Medicare, Medicaid, they do so in exchange for being regulated by these rules.
That's exactly right. The Nursing Home Reform Act has provisions that apply for both the Medicare and the Medicaid programs, so that if the facility accepts Medicare or Medicaid, again, that's going to be most facilities, then even if you are not yourself Medicare or a Medicaid resident, those rules still apply to you.
So here, those are the six reasons that they'll give. But why is a legal eviction so common? Like, what's the reason why it's happening so often across the country?
It really is an increasingly common problem. It is, as I said before, the leading complaint about nursing homes, and thousands of people a year throughout the country are finding themselves facing illegal eviction. And I think that there are several reasons for this. One, as Cindy Lauper sang, money changes everything, right? So nursing facilities
right.
want
good reference.
The highest paying customers they can get.
Right.
No secret there. So money is one of the drivers, certainly not the only one, but it's a significant one. If you can get private pay to pay a higher rate for that stay than Medicare, that's great. If you can get Medicare to pay instead of Medicaid, that's great. And that's because, in particular, with respect to Medicare and Medicaid, Medicare has a higher reimbursement rate than Medicaid. So if you are running a nursing facility, you would like to have the opportunity to serve as many of the higher-paying residents as you can. And because, as we said, you have a right to be there, once you're there, provided you qualify for the services of a skilled nursing facility, then once you're there, you have a right to be there. And it can be difficult for the nursing facilities to get their heads around that sometimes. And so, unfortunately, they really have an incentive financially to try to turn people over so that they can have a better bottom line, especially if you can get rid of someone that is perceived to be costly or difficult. which is a real problem. And the problem is even more acute because these facilities are so often understaffed, and the staff that they have are frequently undertrained or ill-equipped to deal with the difficult but very common issues that arise in a nursing facility. Residents can communicate and behave in ways that are challenging in an everyday setting, yelling, acting out, wandering. Maybe a lot easier to try to discharge a, quote-unquote difficult resident than provide the services that individual resident is entitled to receive. But, nursing facilities exist to help care for the people who have physical and cognitive issues, and you can only be involuntarily discharged for those six reasons. Being difficult, needy, or needing a lot of help isn't one of those reasons. In addition, you get away with it, in part because a lot of people don't know their rights, which I think is one of the great values of having a podcast like this to help educate people. People don't know that they have a right to 30 days notice, for example, before they are evicted, or that they have the right to appeal a decision by the nursing facility. Many of those who even are aware of those rights are unable to exercise them. The long-term care ombudsman can be helpful, but there aren't enough of them, and it's difficult oftentimes to get that help that you need. And then frankly, in a situation that we are experiencing firsthand with one of our clients, that even if you know your rights and you exercise them and you appeal and you get a successful decision that says that the nursing facility has wrongfully evicted you, there can be no meaningful enforcement. And so we have a case where someone was wrongfully discharged and her son, valiantly representing his mom, was able to appeal, and the state agency said, yes, she was wrongfully evicted, and nursing facility, you need to take her back. The facility essentially thumbed its nose at her and her son, continued to deny her readmission, and frankly, the state of California didn't do anything about it. So it's pretty shameful, and it's frustrating, and it compounds the problems that families face in that situation.
So the money is the main driver, from what I understand. And you touched on the difference between Medicare and Medicaid and reimbursement for family members of nursing home residents that may not kind of understand that. Can you kind of unpack what that means? What does reimbursement mean? What does Medicare mean? What does Medicaid mean? Why are they different? Why is that important from the nursing home standpoint? And why is that being the genesis for people being evicted?
Sure. Many people are familiar with Medicare, which will typically cover parts of your health care. It's a very complicated program, as anybody who's tried to navigate through that with Part A, Part B, D, and so on. But essentially, Medicare will cover, for our purposes, I think most relevant here, your part of your hospital stay. Mm-hmm. So people oftentimes will go into a nursing facility coming out of a hospital that they were treated at for some sort of acute need, and then they need to go to a nursing facility because they're not ready to deal with treating themselves on an outpatient basis. So they need some inpatient care. Maybe it's some physical or occupational therapy. So Medicare, which generally will cover people 65 and older, will cover up to 100 days, generally speaking, for the care that's provided in a skilled nursing facility after they have spent at least 3 days in a hospital. And so if you were admitted to the nursing facility from a hospital where you've stayed for a few days and you're going to the nursing facility to help you recover from that condition that you went to the hospital for, Medicare will pay for up to 100 days. That's 20 days for a full day, full payment, and then co-payment for another 80. Medicaid is a program that is a federal and state program that varies a little bit from every state, but generally speaking will cover lower income individuals. So Medicare is automatically because of age. Medicaid is principally based on income, and there's, I think, a misconception for many that Medicare is the principal payer of nursing home and long-term care. And actually, most of the nursing home care in the country is covered by Medicaid, not Medicare. As I said, Medicare is only going to be on a shorter-term basis, and Medicaid will cover longer-term. But because of the way that each program is structured and the rules that they have, Medicaid actually pays less for those services than Medicare, which gets back to, as I said earlier, the incentive for nursing facilities to try to get rid of lower-paying Medicaid beneficiaries for a higher-paying Medicare beneficiary, for example.
So that makes sense. So that's kind of, to encapsulate what you're saying for the audience then, is that because often, not every time, but often Medicare, particularly when there's an acute case stay, and there's a nursing home or rehab after that acute care stay, Medicare often pays for the first 100 days, at which time the individual needs to either private pay themselves, or they can apply, or maybe they're already eligible for Medicaid, and at that point Medicaid kicks in. But the nursing home is not a huge fan of that because their profit margin is going to be cut because Medicaid does not pay for the same services as much as Medicare does.
That's right.
And that's, and when a lot of times in the press and in articles that I've read about the good work that you guys are doing at AARP, I hear about the Medicare 100-day rule. That's kind of what that is.
Right. So that coverage for Medicare in terms of having 100 days, as I said, I think it is, they'll pay for 20 days in full, and then the other 80 days there is a co-payment or daily co-insurance that one would share between Medicare and the individual. But after that 100 days, Medicare is done. So then, as you said, someone would have to rely on private pay, or oftentimes someone, if they don't have sufficient income or assets, may newly qualify for Medicaid or may have already been Medicaid eligible, in which case then the individual may be trying to change status from having Medicare pay for that nursing home stay to having Medicaid pay for it.
So tell me then about the wrongful evictions that you guys are fighting based on that specific story, that the nursing home says, yeah, we'll take you, but you know, but what they're not saying to the residents, we're only going to take you for the 100 days while the money's hot, and then we're going to throw you out after that. How widespread is that? And tell me about, you know, essentially, you know, your understanding of that in the cases that you've had.
This is a widespread problem. It happens as we are learning and getting more involved in this issue in states throughout the country. And we're seeing increased attention and activity at the federal level as well as at the state level and in both the private and public sectors. So, for example, the state of Maryland, through its attorney general, last year had settled a case involving a company called Neiswanger Management, and effectively was able to sue the company and settle to prohibit them from operating nursing facilities in Maryland because they were essentially dumping poor patients at homeless shelters or other inadequate living facilities as soon as they can no longer bill Medicare for their care. To your point, thinking about, let's try to get hospitals to send us the facility, those prime short-term rehabilitative Medicare-paying customers, and if our beds are filled with the lower-paying, frequently more intensively medically or otherwise needy, behaviorally challenging Medicaid folks for whom we are not getting as much reimbursement, then we need to find ways to get them out. And there were some particularly egregious examples cited in that case. We're filing and have filed a lawsuit in California in which we represent a woman named Gloria Single and her son Aubrey. Ms. Single was then 82 years old. She lived in a facility Sacramento with her 93-year-old husband, Bill, and she was one of these people at nursing facilities who would say, well, they were being difficult. And if you remember, one of the criteria that you can actually evict someone for is if they're presenting some kind of danger to health or safety of others in the facility. So the facility, in our case, called police to say that Miss Single was acting out and that she was a threat to her own safety and the safety of others. So the police come, they take her to the hospital. Within hours, the hospital look at her and say she's fine. She doesn't need acute care. And they said, you can take her back now. And the facility refused to take her back. So think about that. You have your 82-year-old mother who lives with your 93-year-old father. You are now essentially denying her the ability to go back to where her husband is, right? She has cognitive impairments as it is. It was traumatic, undoubtedly, to forcibly transfer her from her home into a hospital, and then she's just laying in the hospital and not able to go back to be with her husband. So this is a terrible situation, unfortunately. We think this happens with great frequency. She lived at the nursing facility for, I think, 5 years before this happened. She was in the hospital for 4 months. I mean, this is not just something that dragged on for a few days or a week or two while they sorted some things out. She was in that hospital for 4 months. And as you know, if you're in the hospital, they're not there to provide you with the kind of long-term care that a skilled nursing facility is going to provide you. So within that four-week period at the hospital, she lost her ability to speak, her ability to walk. She deteriorated quite quickly because they're really there to deal with her acute needs. They're not there to make sure that she is getting the kind of occupational or rehabilitative therapeutic services that the nursing facility would get. Eventually, they found her another facility being away from her husband and further away from her son. So now this is becoming an even more isolating experience for Miss Single. Just an awful and traumatic situation. Her son, who's a wonderful client to have, is dedicated to trying to get his mom back into the facility to be with his dad and obviously make it easier for him to be able to visit and connect with his parents. Files an appeal, actually has a hearing. The state issues an order saying that the facility did not satisfy the criteria for a lawful eviction, ordered the facility to take her back, and the facility never took her back. So we've learned more from colleagues throughout the country about this issue, and our colleagues here within the AARP Family Enterprise Legal Counsel for the Elderly, which is the long-term care ombudsman for the District of Columbia, and really learning so much more about these awful stories like those of Miss Single, and got involved so that not just Miss Single, but all of the Miss Singles out there can make sure that they have the right to remain in accordance with the federal regulations that apply. Notwithstanding all of our efforts, and the case is ongoing, we're currently in discovery so that we have not only that individual facility, but the whole family of facilities, because we're trying to make sure that the system overall is held accountable for these errors. But Ms. Single unfortunately passed away recently. So she spent such a long period of time, the last 18 to 20 months of her life, isolated from her husband, because the facility found her essentially to be difficult to take care of, a Medicaid patient who would not, or a resident who would be taking up some space and would cost too much to take care of appropriately. And so she lost the opportunity to have her last days and months with her husband, adding additional stress, I'm sure, to him as well as to her son. We continue to represent her son so that we can get some meaningful change in behavior by facilities like Pioneer, not only in California, but then looking more broadly for some national change.
Wow, that's a tragic story. I wish you guys the best of luck on that. I mean, that's, I hope that you guys get what you need in discovery to uncover what's been going wrong with that chain and put a stop to it. But I just think it's amazing that of the six reasons, I guess the only one that they could try to throw against the wall and stick would be the one that's either a danger to the others or a health danger to the other, or a safety problem or a health problem to others. Otherwise, I mean, you know, I don't know. Like, is that kind of what you're seeing overall? Is that those are the two reasons that they give to throw these people out after 100 days, which I feel like, and then after any level of looking at the books, oh, everybody becomes unruly at approximately the 99th day. You know, like it's...
That's right. So you see what we're seeing is claims about safety and health, as well as the first basis where they say the residents' needs cannot be met in the facility. That's not really what that provision is meant to accomplish. It's not, this person is too difficult and we can't take care of him or her. If you have if a person develops a particular condition that your facility is not qualified to take care of, that may be that then you need to transfer that individual to some other facility or environment because you don't have the capacity to
like
deal with
to
something that you were not expecting or that person didn't come in with.
Like they need to be quarantined or something, or like, you know, some component where, yeah, they're not equipped from a device or a mechanical or physical standpoint to treat.
Right. Not that, wow, this person's dementia has gotten worse. You're a nursing facility. You deal, presumably, in this situation with dementia and cognitive impairments. So that means that you need to do a better job of providing the care that person needs. It's, again, not that this person has become too difficult and that it's in the best interests of that individual resident's welfare to go be dealt with by somebody else.
Exactly.
And that, I think, is often another cover that a facility will use to try to deal with people who are difficult, costly, or otherwise require a more intensive level of expensive care that they would rather not have to provide.
Right. I mean, I'm glad that case is ongoing. I'm glad that Aubrey, the son, has the wherewithal to keep it moving forward. Because I mean, I think that as long as y'all keep fighting, you'll get the good result, or at least from one standpoint, you bring it to the court of public opinion.
Right, and I think that is a very important place for us and other advocates to be, is that you need not only some court victories and some helpful settlements that get at behavioral and systemic changes by the facilities, but I think we have already seen an increase in media coverage and attention, even by the federal government and HHS issuing some additional guidance and memoranda about this problem. And so I think that court of public opinion is very powerful, getting states to really take ownership of a very serious problem, and not only to empower and provide appropriate resources for the state long-term care ombudsman, who can be very helpful allies, but also to ensure that they put mechanisms in place to help to promote the compliance with rules that are already there. And frankly, recognizing that resources can be limited at the public level, if they can do some legislative fixes or changes to enable private entities to be able to bring lawsuits to hold these facilities accountable for those violations of federal law and standards of care, I think that'll go a long way in deterring bad behavior and in getting them to provide the service that the people are entitled to.
Exactly. Well said. Bill, one more thing before we go. What are a couple of things that a family of a loved one that is facing wrongful eviction can do, or what are a couple of resources that you may recommend for them? Where can they go?
So I think it is always helpful to try to get to know the long-term care ombudsman. They are available in each state. They are there to help the advocates for residents to identify any concerns that they have with facilities. There is, under the federal regulations now, a requirement that the residents, that any residence eviction has to trigger a notice to the state long-term care ombudsman. But in truth, as I said earlier, they're under-resourced and overburdened in many respects. So getting notices like this on a monthly or other basis is not going to provide sufficient relief for families or opportunities to deal with the exercise of their rights for an appeal, for example, and ensuring that both procedurally and substantively the facility is doing what it's supposed to do. So I think that if you have a loved one in a facility, you should start getting to know the long-term care ombudsman's office so that if you find that you are facing a situation like this, you can be proactive, because you really do need to be proactive in this environment. I think that, you know, oftentimes the state health agencies have resources for dealing with nursing home issues as well. But also, I think, you know, the legal profession, your firm, organizations like AARP and AARP Foundation, CANR, the California Advocates for Nursing Home Reform, and other organizations around the country can be very helpful in trying to connect the families and residents of facilities to legal and other services that can be helpful. The National Consumer Voice for Long-Term Care is another good organization that has resources with respect to long-term care facilities and ombudsman in every state, and has resources on this issue as well.
Fantastic. That's great. Those are great resources. We often have on this program ombudsmen, not only from Georgia, but we've had ombudsmen from New Mexico, from Oklahoma. The ombudsmen are a great resource, a great group of advocates, no matter what state you're in. But Bill, I really appreciate you being on the show. I don't know if you ever see Iris Gonzalez walking around in the halls where you're at. She was a guest on our show, a couple years ago.
Yeah, she is a dear friend and colleague. So we are always happy to help participate and to spread the word. And you know, we recognize the work that we are engaged in here is very difficult, both legally and jurisprudentially, but also on the human level and in a very personal way. So, you know, we really appreciate you doing this and being a leader in this space to help educate people and alert people of their rights and talk about things that are really critically important to families across the country.
Appreciate that, Bill. And again, we hats off to you guys. You guys are fighting the real fight, and we appreciate that. But awesome. Well, Bill, thank you so much for your time and your expertise. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
All right. I was telling Bill before we went to air that he has a voice for radio, probably a face for TV. I don't know what he looks like at this point, but I found him to be extremely knowledgeable and very well versed in this, and could rattle off those things at the top of his head. And not a lot of people can do that. And that's probably what makes him an excellent trial lawyer, is that he can speak so persuasively and so well right off the top of his head. Great, great lawyer, great guy. The AARP Foundation is a fantastic organization. Their litigation wing, we've had, as I've mentioned, we had other members of AARP on the show before. They're doing great work out there, and we appreciate what they're doing. But that is actually going to conclude this episode. You can catch this episode, you can catch this podcast in general. You can catch us online at our YouTube channel or at our website, which is nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. Or you can check us out wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every other Monday. That is bi-monthly, 2 times a month. What is that? 24 times a year, thereabouts, give or take. Or you can go back and listen to old episodes. We're now at episode 140. So that's 140 opportunities to learn about nursing homes, nursing home rights, residents' rights, that kind of thing. We appreciate you with you. We appreciate you being with us. And with that, we'll see you next time.
Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Nothing said on this podcast, either by the host or the guest, should be construed as legal advice, nor is intended to create an attorney-client relationship between the host or their guest and the listener. New episodes are available every Monday on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, or on your favorite podcast app, as well as on YouTube and our website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. Again, that's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.